Hello and welcome to the Bucket List Gamers podcast. I am Jay, and as always, I'm joined by Eddie.
Hello.
And as we go through the final phases of the list, we are down to four games, and today is a special one for us because it's a game we both like, which is scarce coming towards the end of this list. It's a game we feel like we can talk quite a bit about. Again, bit of a scarcity in the latter stage of this list. So without further ado, let me announce the game, which is The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time.
Woo-woo!
There we go. I told you I had a surprise for this episode, and that noise was it. But not just that, because you've got to take the rough with the smooth, so occasionally throughout the episode you'll also be hearing,
"Hey, listen!"
Just interrupting from time to time, as is the custom. So, Ocarina of Time, one of your favourites, I know it is. I don't know if I said it was number two in the list, and it came out in 1998. I think I got lost in the moment a bit there with the sound. So yeah, 1998, number two on the list, so not number one. We're saving that for the last episode. And yeah, N64, it was one of my favourites. I didn't own it when it very first came out. Didn't have an N64, as we've covered. But I loved playing it. I used to play it quite a lot at friends' houses. And yeah, it was just, I don't know if it was unlike anything that came before it, but it certainly felt like it was. The whole size of the world and the amount of things to do and all that just felt really expansive.
Yeah, it's hard to describe how groundbreaking this game was, particularly for me as a relatively young gamer, because 1998, I was, what, 13? 12, possibly, because I think it came out December over here. So I was like pushing into my first year as a teenager. And having played other Zelda games prior to this, nothing could prepare me for how blown away I was playing this game. And it's, everyone always goes to their de facto, oh, it's when you walk out onto Hyrule Field. It didn't even matter to me that bit. I'd already been blown away by the first hour where you wake up as Link, you get your fairy, you go into the Deku Tree,
hey,
and you fight your first... There we go. You fight your first boss. It's, nothing could have prepared my young mind for how good this game was. It was at a point where you were used to Zelda titles sort of having a story, but it was usually quite vague. It was done through two or three text boxes of a conversation with someone in the environment. And it was still 2D, it was sort of isometric. Whereas this, they just took the formula and went, do you know what? We need to do this game justice. We've got this vision for this massive open world, this action RPG, and it's gonna have a good story. And it does. And all of it just fits together so well. Even little side characters and little asides that you can do all fit together so well. That it's been the mainstay, in terms of the template anyway, it's been the mainstay of the Zelda series ever since. Everything else that's come after it has been built on Ocarina.
Yeah, yeah, and there's been a few missteps where they've strayed from that.
Yeah.
I think stuff like, well, I don't know, Twilight Princess isn't considered a misstep by most, is it? But I didn't enjoy it as much as this. I just think they tried to do too much with it. Probably with that one compared to this. It wasn't safe, but it was all, I don't know, like you say, it all made sense and it flowed and it was fine. And then you get Twilight Princess and it's like, oh, now you're a dog for no real reason. And it just, I don't know, there was something about that one that it didn't hit as hard as this one. Maybe it was the age thing. And like you say, it wasn't as big an advancement as Link to the Past to this was. And then Skyward Sword was just nah, because they ruined it with the motion controls.
Yeah, I think Twilight Princess is, if Ocarina had been made later in sort of like Nintendo's life, Twilight Princess is the game they would have made.
Hmm.
So if we didn't get Ocarina, we would have got Ocarina, but done up to the scale and with the slightly more gritty feel to it that you get in Twilight Princess. And Twilight Princess is such a massive nodding homage to Ocarina. There are character references and there are story beats in it that refer back to Ocarina. You do need to understand and fully appreciate Twilight Princess and all the intricacies and stuff like that. You do need to have played Ocarina beforehand. And it's not very often you can say that about a Zelda game. They don't heavily rely on one another. They're usually quite standalone.
Yeah. Even Majora's Mask, you don't really have had to have played Ocarina, do you? Because it's all alternative world. Whereas, yeah, that one, you could still get it, but there's loads of references you'd miss. And little nods and stuff like that. And even bits where you probably go, what's that about? And then just never understand it. But yeah, I just wasn't as big a fan of it. I don't know if it was the bits where you turn into a wolf that... I think that's the bit that took me out of it. I didn't really care for those bits. If they'd have not had those bits in it and just made it more linked, more Ocarina-y and the dungeon exploring and stuff, probably would have liked it a bit more. And I don't remember absolutely despising it or anything. I just didn't finish it, and that's usually a sign to me that I've not got on with it as well as I have some other ones. Because usually I'll push through, and like I said, I think I've said in the past, Wind Waker, didn't finish it the first time. And then when I got it on the Wii U, I sort of determined to get to the end of it. And same for Ocarina. I didn't finish it back in the day. And then when I got the GameCube Special Edition, I finished Majora's Mask first, bizarrely, because I did always prefer that game slightly, because I don't know what it is about Majora's Mask. I think it's the time mechanic, like we talked way back in episode 2 or whatever it was. I just liked that whole, you're on this cycle and you have to keep resetting it, and it's a bit clever. Not to say that I didn't love Ocarina as well, it's just I preferred that structure and trying to get it all done in those 3 days. It gave me a target to aim for, whereas in Ocarina, it's very easy to just wander off, isn't it, and not know what you're actually meant to be doing anymore, because you've just gone off adventuring for yourself and you've completely forgot what somebody's told you to go and do, and then you have to figure it back out again. So I think that's why I prefer Majora's Mask, but Ocarina's got a lot of sort of good memories for me. I remember going to a couple of parties when I was younger, like sleepover type things, and people had brought their N64s or they got one. And we ended up just playing it all night, like with a film on in the background. So we got two TVs. We were playing Ocarina and then had a film on. I remember one party I went to, one of my friends was like obsessed with catching that really rare fish in the fishing mini game.
Oh, yeah.
So he literally did the fishing mini game for about 7 hours while we were all just having this party. And everyone else is like drinking and having a good time. And he's just literally sat in the middle of everyone on this TV set trying to catch this fish. And I don't think he ever actually did. Because isn't there something, you have to get a sinking lure, don't you? And you're not technically allowed to use that. And there's some special way you have to do it.
Yeah, so there are a couple of ways you can do it. One of them is with the sinking lure, which if the fisherman who owns the fishing hole catches you with it, your fish is disqualified anyway. But there is a trick to using the iron boots and the Zora tunic. So it's in the deepest part of the pond, and you obviously have to reel it in. And it's because of its size, the rod snaps really easily. So you end up having sat in this cycle of getting it really close to you, and then it just suddenly pulls really hard on the rod while you're pulling back on it, and it snaps the rod instantly. Whereas if you wade in with the Zora tunic, which allows you to breathe underwater, and the boots, which allow you to sink to the bottom, you cast your rod and it's practically face to face with you anyway. So you just reel it in really quickly and you get it that way. So there are a couple, you can do it the proper way, but like you say, it's hours of your life you will end up dropping into that just to get it.
What do you even get? Is it just a heart container?
Yeah.
So not really worth it. So for anyone out there that doesn't know what Ocarina of Time is, I can't imagine there's many people listening to us that don't know what this game is. But to sum it up, it's a 3D Zelda game with a massive, expansive open world, loads of characters in it to interact with, loads of little side quests to do. The main storyline is that Ganondorf has kidnapped Zelda again, I think, isn't it? Unless I'm completely mistaken it.
Yeah, it's a very odd start to the story. So you wake up, you're called by... You are a boy who lives in the forest with a bunch of other Kokiri people who are small... They're kids that never grow up, so it's a bit Peter Pan-y in that respect. On the, I think it's their 10th birthday, they all get given a fairy. However, hey, Link listen. Is over the age and he's never had a fairy come to him. So he's a bit of an outcast within the community. And eventually the Great Deku Tree, who is the protector and the guardian of the Kokiri Forest, sends Navi to you.
Hey, listen!
And he quests you with going to save the princess because there is everyone is having sort of ominous dreams and it's all the world in fire. And at the center of it, the center of the dreams constantly is a light shining from Kokiri Forest, and the light beams towards Hyrule Castle, and there is a vision of Princess Zelda. So you are to go and seek her out and find out why this vision is happening to people. And that's where you sort of kick off.
And then I remember the cutscene very vividly where Ganondorf flies in on a horse, doesn't he, and snatches... Is it Zelda that he snatches away and rides off with her, and then you sort of get chucked in the dirt, don't you?
Yeah, so you get to Hyrule Castle after doing the first bullshit side questy, go to the three dungeons, get the three gems, come back to me once you've got all this, and then we can go fight Ganondorf because we've got these three gems, even though you're only 10. And you get to the castle, and a horse gallops past you with Princess Zelda and her attendant called Impa, and they are pursued by Ganondorf. Link sort of stands in the way, tries to be the little hero that he is, and Ganondorf literally flattens him with dark magic and just says, "You literally have no chance of standing up to me. Get out of my way, kid," and rides off after them. And it's at that point that you decide, you are told that you aren't powerful enough. You need to go to the Temple of Time, and it should unlock your power. You then get frozen in time for 7 years, and you come back as an adult in the game's terms.
Yeah, because this is the first time they've done the whole child-adult thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the other Zelda games, you're just Link of a certain age. It's quite indeterminate in the NES ones. And then in the SNES one, you look like a child to me, but you never really advance from that, do you? You just go into the dark world. It's dark and light in that one. Whereas this one is very much dark and light still, but you age 7 years and become adult Link, who has more abilities or can use things in different ways, can't he? And has more strength and that kind of thing. So it completely changes the game mechanic when you advance into that adult stage. And I know, like you said earlier on, a lot of people say for them the moment they got blown away was when they come out on Hyrule Field and you see the vastness of it and you see everything in front of you. For me, the moment I got blown away is when you age 7 years and you come out of the Temple of Time for the first time, and the volcano in the background's got the big cloud around it. Is it Mount Doom?
Yeah, it is Mount Doom.
Wrong, sir! Wrong!
Because I was watching something earlier on about Lord of the Rings, and it's Mount Doom in that one as well, isn't it? And I was like, they can't use the same name. But yeah, there's a big cloud of smoke around it, isn't it? All the sky's red. And then you walk into the square and there's all those re-deads. And yes. That for me is the bit where I was like, wow, this isn't just a kid's game like the other Zeldas are. This has got genuine horrors in it. And it does get worse from there, doesn't it? The re-deads aren't even the worst bits.
Yeah, it does go from nicey-nicey, little kid. It starts off a bit earthboundy. In fact, I think the entire plot is very earthboundy if you take away all the sort of intricacies of the plot and what have you. But if you just take it on bare bones, it is kids go out to save the universe. And that is exactly what you're doing in Zelda. You're a little kid who's been quested to save Hyrule, and everyone talks down to you. All the guards think you're just a little kid. You have to sneak past the guards to get to Zelda because they think you're just loitering basically. They don't think you're a threat or anything like that. And then it goes from 0 to 100 really fast. So you go into the Temple of Time, you get aged 7 years, and you walk out, and as you say, everything is just decimated. And every place you go to that you've visited so far on your journey has been afflicted in some way. So, like you say, the mountain has got a ring of fire and is currently terrorized by a massive dragon that's been resurrected. The Zora domain has been frozen over. And I think you only ever speak to two Zoras as an adult. And one is the king that you have to defrost. And the other is Princess Ruto, who you met as a child. And she's one of the seven sages, ultimately.
And there's a lot of harrowing things in the adult part of it. Because like you say, you go from nothing to everything. So you go from a side quest where you've got to find a woman's dog, where she's like, you're the hero of time, and she's got you out looking for a bloody dog, and you have to just keep picking dogs up and bringing them back to her until she decides one of them's hers, to going down a well and this like blob that can create hands out the floor starts coming after you. And that is, it's genuinely scary. Like the bit down the well for a 12-year-old or something or whatever we were, even then it was fairly terrifying to see graphics that we weren't used to seeing this good do something horrific like that, and in what you expect to be when you start playing it, a kid's game. And it's not the whole way through, is it? And there are some lightheartedness to it, like Dampe and stuff like that, who it's a bit morbid, but it's lighthearted at the same time. And then the pose aren't particularly scary and that kind of thing. But then you go down that well and there are genuinely horrible things down there, and you just want to get out of it as quickly as you can.
Yeah, and I think the well in particular is a fantastic example of how the game allows you to flip between child and adult Link. So at certain points in the plot, you get to you hit a brick wall, and it's like, oh, you can't progress any further as your adult form. You need an item, and the item's down the well, but the well's caved in. However, if you go back in time, if you go back into the temple, put the Master Sword back, you'll go back 10 years in time to when you were a kid, and you're able to then go down the well to get this item. I think it's the Lens of Truth. That you need to be able to get through the desert as an adult. But even then, as an adult, you need to go back as a kid as well, once you've already got there as an adult, and you can warp and stuff like that. So it's very, to quote Doctor Who, wibbly wobbly timey wimey, it's very overlappy in terms of the fact that the child and the adult bits interlink and overlap quite heavily. But yeah, the dead hand at the bottom of the well, which is that horrendous lump of flesh with a really skinny neck and a massive set of jaws on the front of it that just summons hands out of, like, yeah, horrifying for a kid. That is not what you want to see.
I mean, it's bad enough when the Redeads like jump on you back and you don't know how to get them off the first time you see them. But that, yeah, the thing down the well, it's unbelievably adult for a game that has been primarily set in a kid's space for that long. And yeah, I think there's a lot of darker themes in that game as well, aren't there? Even which carries on into Majora, as we've explained. There's a hell of a lot of dark stuff in Majora if you are looking for it and you're in the frame of mind to understand it, rather than just seeing it through a kid's eyes and being like, oh, it's quite funny, there's a hand in the toilet and all that rubbish. Whereas that, if you actually look into the reasons behind the like people's stories, a lot of them are quite tragic, like we've covered before. And you don't get that as much in Ocarina, but there's still elements of that. And there's that overarching dread again, not so much from what you get from the moon in Majora, but it's still there, this idea that the princess has been kidnapped. And especially from your perspective, you know what's going to happen unless you change things. And it's that feeling of needing to do something. And I love a game where you can affect the future by going into the past. It's one of my favorite types of mechanics in games, and I think it stems from Day of the Tentacle, because that was one of my earliest gaming memories. And that's very similar in that you've got three people in three different time periods, and you have to do something in the past so that then somebody in the future can do what they need to do, and it goes backwards and forwards. So I feel like I appreciate that mechanic quite a lot, and to implement it here, like you said, it's really well done. There are clear bits where you go, right, I can't do any more in this state, so I need to go back to my old younger self and figure out what's to be done there now, and then go back forward once that's done. And like you say, it's not just a one-way street. There'll be bits where you do stuff as an adult that then affects what you can do as a child, weirdly enough. And yeah, it's very well done, very well put together. And like I said earlier on, you can get lost in it, but I think it is also very good at signposting what you need to do next. And it's very rare that there's a couple of times I can think in it where you don't have a clue what to do whatsoever. One that I can think of is, I can't, it's been so long since I played it, but there's a bit where you have to fire an arrow into the sun to get fire arrows, isn't there? And it sort of does spell it out for you if you listen to the owl, but most people just ignore the owl when it's trying to give you, like, and I think a lot of people forget about the owl completely, but there's this huge owl following you around the whole game giving you hints, isn't there? But yeah, a lot of people just skip through what it says, and then, yeah, there's a bit where you have to fire an arrow into the sun. Is it setting over the lake or something like that? There's a very specific place, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a grave. So once you've completed the water temple as an adult and the lake Hylia fills back up again, you find yourself on top, onto sort of like a warp stone on the top, and there's a grave at the bottom of a tree across the lake from you, and it gives you some sort of riddle in as much as, you know, it's quite, it points you in that direction. And it's, yeah, along the lines of you need to fire an arrow between the boughs of the tree when the sun is setting. So basically you've just got to swim back across to where your warp point was and then wait for the sun to start setting as an adult. Fire an arrow between the tree boughs as it sets over the lake and you get your fire arrows. And they're not integral to the plot. You can get through the entire game without them because you do have other methods of utilizing fire, but it does make your playthrough infinitely more easy to have them rather than to pick out with sticks.
Yeah, there's little bits like that I like because you have to use a bit of ingenuity. It never feels like it's too obscure. And like you say, you get that little riddle, and if you've got any sense, you can put it together. And then I think another thing they did quite well was introduce, once you've got, is it the Mask of Truth? You can speak to the Seeing Stones, can't you?
Yes.
And they will give you hints. So you can go through it if you want without any sort of hints. Whereas if you get that mask, you can then start asking the stones and they'll give you little tidbits of like, oh, you maybe do this or maybe go here or maybe put something in this place, etc. And then you get those little, so it's slightly worked a hint system into it. But even then, they're a bit cryptic, aren't they? They're not, it's not literally just, you need to go here now. It's more sort of phrased as a, oh, it might be interesting if you bombed this particular wall or something like that. It's,
yeah, and not all of them are practical. Some of them, it depends on the seeing stone that you hit as well. So some of them will just give you sort of banal observations of characters in the overworld. It's like, oh, the postman that runs across the field, he runs really far and he runs about 20 miles a day. And you just go, well, that's no fucking use to me, is it?
Isn't, if you like bomb them, don't they turn into rockets and shoot off into the sky, bizarrely? So there's some absurd stuff in there, which I think got dialed up for Majora's Mask, didn't it? But there are hints of it in this one. And yeah, it is just a brilliant game. I mean, everyone complains about the Water Temple. I didn't personally mind the Water Temple. I don't generally like water levels in games, but I didn't think the Water Temple was that bad. I recall one bit in it where you have to sort of jump onto a platform and look up and hookshot through into another floor, that was quite tricky. But other than that, I didn't think it was bad. It's just a lot of pushing buttons and figuring out where the water level rises to, isn't it? And yeah, I don't think it's, for me, Jabu Jabu's Belly is the worst dungeon in it. I really dislike that one. And I think it's because when I very first played it, I wasn't very well. It was just shortly before I got rushed into hospital. And I think I associate the two
with
like playing that level and then immediately being rushed into hospital like less than a day later. And now I just, if I play that level, it gives me a genuine headache whenever I do Jabu Jabu's belly, so I have to get through it really quickly when I'm playing it, and I've come to know it quite well now because I just have to get through it as quick as I can.
So to pick up on one of your previous points, to be fair, that is one of the bits that I find a bit obtuse. Not now, because I've played the game God knows how many times that I can remember it like the back of my hand, but getting access to Jabu Jabu's belly is really obtuse and isn't directly explained to you what you have to do. You go up, you find this massive fish manatee thing on an altar, and you can't get in. It just won't let you in. And for some sort of bizarro logic that's akin to sort of like Monkey Island levels of a bit abstract, you have to go catch a fish in a bottle and then open the bottle to let the fish out for Jabu Jabu to think that you're feeding him and inhale you into his stomach. I mean, that is just, it makes sense once you know it, but to just go, oh, I need to get a fish so this fucker will eat me, it just doesn't make any sense logically at all in the context of the rest of the game.
No, and there's no point where it leads you into that, is there? Because there's no other point where you need to catch a fish in a bottle for any other purpose. Like, if it was bugs, because you catch bugs in bottle and put them in little holes quite a lot, don't you? So if it was sort of teaching you that in the earlier stages, and then you got to that and went, oh, maybe I need to pour some bugs in here, in his blowhole or whatever, because it looks like the little holes that are on the floor, then that would be logical. But at no other point do you have to catch a fish in a bottle or chuck a fish in a bottle on the floor, other than can you sell them if you catch them in the bottles? Is that the only other use for it?
Yeah, that's about it. And you can water the holes that you put bugs into. Mm. You can put seeds into them as well and water them to get little seedlings, which then as an adult become like floating platforms. But other than that, there is no use for fish at all.
Yeah, there's a couple of bits like that in it, isn't there? But it's thankfully it's few and far between. But that is one where you are scratching your head for a bit until you've done it once, and then it just becomes obvious. The few other things I think that annoyed me in Ocarina, there aren't many. I think the giant's sword is one of them, or the giant's knife, is it?
Yeah.
Because you go through a right trauma to get it, and then it just breaks, doesn't it, after like four or five swings? And I always thought, am I doing something wrong? Is there like a way I can temper this so that it doesn't happen? But there isn't, is there? So you have to just potentially save that for when you need it most and get a couple of swings out of it, and that's it.
Yeah, so there are two separate knives, essentially. So they're made by the big Gorons, which are the giant-ass Gorons that live on top of... It's Death Mountain. It's not
Death Mountain.
It's Death Mountain.
I knew it wasn't right.
Yeah. As soon as I said, oh, yeah, no, that's right, in the back of my head, I was going, it's wrong, but I can't tell you what it is that's wrong about it.
Where was she?
Yeah, hey,
listen.
That's
what exactly. I
know. So, yeah, there's one who's less talented than the other. The less talented one is the one that charges you money for it. And it's a lot of money. It's like 500 rupees and the damn thing breaks. Or you can go on, I think it's like a 14 or 15 point fetch quest to get these sorts of things. And a part of it is timed. You have to run from Lake Hylia to the top of Death Mountain. You can't warp because it spoils, because you're carrying something, eye drops. Eye drops for the Goron on top of the mountain so he can put them in his eyes. And you get something like a 2.5 minute timer, which is doable, but it's got to be a perfect run. You've got to know where you're going, who you're talking to, how to get up the mountain the quickest. And then you get the proper Goron sword that doesn't break. But yeah, I like the side quest, though. It's a bit masochistic of me, but yeah, I do like it.
Yeah, I remember, because you have to have the big wallet, don't you, to actually be able to afford the other one. And so you do all the mission to get the big wallet to be able to collect enough rupees to go and buy the giant's knife, and then, it just smashes straight away. And it's such a... like a beginner's trap for him to put in the game, because everyone did that first time they played through that game and then learned better the next time. But it is, yeah, I suppose it is funny in a way, but it just, it is a bit harsh. And I think the other bit of, it's both in the Goron area, the two things that really annoyed me. The other one is the one where you're having to stop that Goron that's like whizzing around the inside of the cave, and you have to chuck bombs near him, don't you, to blow him up, to stop him.
Yeah.
And the amount of times I've just got battered off ledges by him flying past and not blowing up on the bomb like he's supposed to. But other than that, I think it's one of my favourite games, I'd go as far as to say. I don't know, it's a difficult one, because I've got a lot more, not nostalgia, but I've got a lot more love for Majora's Mask that I can't really explain. But I do have a lot of nostalgia for Ocarina, and I also appreciate the fact that we wouldn't have Majora's Mask if it wasn't for how good Ocarina was and how well it did. So I think Ocarina probably just edges it out in terms of those two.
I genuinely struggle with the two of them, because I have played Ocarina of Time far more than I have played Majora's Mask to completion, because I've done Ocarina, I used to replay it again and again. It was the one game that I kept in my N64. It was only when a new game came out that I'd play it, finish it, and then put Ocarina of Time back in. But like you, I have a lot more affection for Majora, and I think it's because they got better at the storytelling side of things and making you feel that attachment to a world and its characters. Ocarina was sort of like the litmus test to sort of get it off the ground, see if it worked, see if the engine ran well, and they did a solid good job at it, and it's an all-round replayable game. Majora has more niggles for me. There are certain parts of Majora's Mask that I don't like replaying again and again. There are certain temples or certain aspects. The Stone Tower Temple, which is the last temple, where you have to keep flipping it upside down constantly. That I didn't enjoy, and I don't like replaying that, which is unfortunate because it's pretty much the last thing you do in the game before you fight the final boss. Whereas this, I could endlessly replay the Water Temple, because although people say it's a challenge, it is, but it's a fair challenge, because all you need to do is look at the map and determine what rooms you haven't looked in yet, lower the water level. Oh, I can't get to it from here. Raise the water level. Have a look in all the other rooms, see if I can get to it from here. And you just process of elimination your way up. So it's not that difficult. And you, in most water levels, the biggest risk to you is running out of oxygen and dying. Don't have that in the Water Temple, because you've got iron boots, which help you sink and walk along the bottom, and a Zora suit that helps you breathe underwater. So there's no risk of death.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing we need to talk about when we're talking about Ocarina is the music.
Oh.
I think it's not very often music makes a game, but I don't think that game would be the same without the brilliant music that's in it. If they'd have not nailed that music as well as they have, then I just don't think it would be as remembered as fondly, as good of a game as it is. I remember the music as much as I remember the gameplay, if not more so. Like, I even sat here now, the tunes are going around in my head. I can hear the forest music with the school kid dancing about on top of that stump. I can hear the marketplace music. It's just, it's so iconic, and you'll hear it in the backgrounds of so many things these days, YouTube videos, people, stuff like that. It just, you hear it and you instantly know what it is. Pretty much every bit of music in that game.
And every single bit of music in that game is tailored, really well tailored, to the environment that it's set in. So normally you get sort of like, in RPGs you get quite orchestral, and it could be anywhere that it plays, really. It's quite homogenous. You could go into a town and it's playing, or it wouldn't matter if they took you out of that, put you in a dungeon and played that same piece of music. It would fit, but it would, it all sort of blends together. Whereas stuff like Gerudo Valley, with the Hispanic sort of mariachi and maracas effect that's going on in the background, it makes you feel like you are in a desert. And it's so well tailored to the environment. It's one of my favourite soundtracks of all time. I have countless versions of the same song downloaded and done by different artists who've obviously got a passion for it, that have done it on acoustic guitar, or they've done full orchestral suites of it, and each one is a beautiful rendition in its own right.
Yeah, and then you've got like Lon Lon Ranch music, which is,
yeah,
it wouldn't fit anywhere else. It's ranch music. It fits perfectly. Yeah. You've got the sort of serenity of Zora's Domain and the music that plays there, because everything's either watery and crystal or frozen completely. So you've got that slower, jangly sort of music to reflect the ice and that kind of thing. You've got the guy in the tower that plays the, is it the Song of Storms on his, yeah, accordion? And that fits with a storm. And then you get the whole, the fact that you can play the music on the ocarina and trigger it whenever you want. And every little bit of music, Epona's song, Saria's song, all the different warp songs are all just iconic and just, they fit where you're warping to. It's hard to explain that without hearing them, but they really do. Like, you know, if you hear that song, right, I'm going to there, or that's Epona's song, Epona's going to show up. And it just all fits perfectly for me.
Yeah, and to sort of demonstrate how integral those tracks have become, it's sort of ingrained into gaming culture. Every single Zelda game that has followed on has had at least one of those tracks done as a slight remix. So even in stuff like Tears of the Kingdom, when you're at a stables, you will hear Lon Lon Ranch music.
Mm.
There is a bird with an accordion who sort of appears at random stables sort of things, and he will play Epona's song. When it starts to rain heavily, you get a slight hint of the Song of Storms in the background.
Yeah.
Just sort of as an undercurrent behind the rainfall. And it same in Breath of the Wild. Majora's Mask obviously had a massive amount of influence from that, but it picked up its own separate songs and own separate soundtrack and built off Ocarina. But even in stuff like Twilight Princess, there were re-renditions of Epona's song for your horse.
Yeah, it's such an integral part of it. I just couldn't imagine it having any different music. And you can say that for some games, like Donkey Kong Country's got fairly iconic music in certain levels, but not all of it. Whereas everything in Zelda, for me, is just perfect. And like you say, you can listen to it over and over and it doesn't get old. And you know, you could walk blindfolded into a place in Zelda, and you'd know where you'd walked into based on what music was playing in the background. It's that link to each location. So yeah, I think the music is one of the things that makes it, and as you said, and probably mine as well, one of my favourite soundtracks in gaming, if not my favourite. I listened to the orchestral one, I think, that you mentioned a few episodes back, and I did like it, but at the same time, I do like just putting on the original sort of N64 style music and just letting it play in the background when I'm doing something. And yeah, it's just, it had everything going for it. It was on a newish system. It showed what that system could do, which absolutely blew away anything Nintendo had done, but also in many respects, anything the PlayStation had done at that time, I would say, in terms of size and quality. And it's just, it's one of the closest things to a perfect game I think you can get in terms of writing, how it played, how it at the time looked, the music. It was just that whole package. And then just into the bargain, it was a gold cartridge as well, wasn't it? Which just made it feel even more special than a regular one. If you had the gold one, I know they did both, didn't they? But yeah. I definitely had a gold one. So it was just, yeah, it was like the perfect storm of things to make this iconic game that still holds up now. Maybe not graphically quite as much, but you can still happily play this game now and get so much enjoyment out of it. And I don't even think some of the remasters they've done hold a torch to the original one. I'd rather play the original than the newest remaster.
Yeah, I mean, the latest remaster for both Ocarina and Majora's was on the 3DS, which was not the console to do it on.
Hmm.
You don't get the 3D does not do anything for it. It doesn't support anything unique. It doesn't do anything for the graphics. The graphics are a lot smoother and a lot nicer, and the modelling on the characters is a lot better. And it's something that comes up year after year whenever people ask for a remake or a remaster of something. Ocarina of Time is one of those that deserves a proper... It and Majora, if you wanted to pair them together, because they are, by modern standards, relatively small games, so you could get them both as a double feature on a disc to do a proper ground-up remake, not change anything fundamentally, not add like shitloads of side quests and what have you, and tittering shit and fannying about. Just a like-for-like, but with better graphics tech. It doesn't have to be realistic graphics. If you want to do it in the style of Tears of the Kingdom, fine, lovely. If you want to do it in the style of Wind Waker, I'd be happy. Just something that looks nicer than it did, it does and it did at the time, because it's very blocky, but it still has that charm to it. It's still that edge of whimsy. So it's not meant to be realistic, even though it probably was at the time.
It's, I think for me, if you compare it to a PS1 game, or the majority of PS1 games, it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Because, and it's using, I know it's 32 to 64 bit, but they weren't getting the full 64 bits out of it, were they, at that point, I wouldn't have said.
No.
And the comparison from a PlayStation game is very night and day, in that PlayStation, the 3D graphics were very blocky and quite muddy colour palettes and all that kind of thing. And then you get Zelda, and yes, it's blocky, but there is attempts to be smoothed and rounded. I mean, the Gorons are quite round, aren't they, for a start, in general. So they got that. Yeah. If that was a PlayStation, they'd have been cubes with the little faces drawn on. So there is, and it's just bright and it's vivid and it looks beautiful. And I think the problem with the 3DS ports was that it deserves to be on, as much as I love a 3DS, it deserves to be on a bigger screen than a like 3.5-inch little compact screen. A game that big deserves to be on a huge TV with a separate controller, not sort of having to move the screen around with your hands as you're controlling it. And it loses a bit of that, because you need to see the detail in it, don't you, in the background to really appreciate it. And on a screen that size, you're not going to get it, no matter how nice they make the graphics look. You need to have Link being sort of a quarter of the screen size, and then the backgrounds take over. And they just don't on the 3DS, because you wouldn't be able to see him or what you were doing if that was the case. So I think, it deserves a Switch remake, or a Switch 2, or whatever they're going to call it, remake. Or even just tidying up what they've already got, even if you don't build it from the ground up. Tidy up what you've got, or like upscale the 3DS ones and take the 3D bit of it out and just make them look nice on a Switch. I mean, I know they broke, was it Majora's Mask they broke on the 3DS? It's practically impossible to complete, isn't it? Because I think it's when you're the Deku Scrub, you can't bounce across those lily pads like you're meant to be able to, because they changed the jump mechanic in it, or the jump animation or something. So that bit is nearly impossible to do, which is another thing that annoys me about remasters and remakes. They did it with Crash Bandicoot as well. Stop trying to change the mechanics. Make the gameplay identical. Just make it look prettier, because the gameplay was largely fine as it was. Then all they did with Crash Bandicoot was make it far harder, because all the edges of the platforms were smoothed off. So you landed on one and then you just gradually slipped into an abyss. But it deserves more than it's got, I think, because it's only had... It had the GameCube one, didn't it? Which, from what I recall, didn't really polish it. They just put it on a disc so you could play it on a GameCube. And then they'd done the Master... Was it the Master Quest or something?
Yeah.
And then, it was the 3DS was the next one, wasn't it? I think they're the only two that it's had, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I mean, it's had ports onto the Switch. I think it had a port onto the Wii U. But it is just that, it's a port. And the architecture's, it doesn't support it, and it doesn't run very well on any of the ones that it's had a port for. I know the GameCube one, Majora, you were lucky if it ran all the way through properly without crashing. Master Quest was done very well. Ocarina was a bit glitchy, there were some odd bits in it where it either didn't save properly or it had a nasty habit of wiping your save file. But the Master Quest, because that had been rebuilt and built from the ground up in terms of remapping the dungeons and changing some of the puzzles around, that was, for me in particular, it was really welcome because it was an actual challenge for someone that had played Ocarina to death by that point, and to go, oh, well, you know those dungeons that you've got used to now, none of them are the same, none of the puzzles make any sense anymore, so go back and try again. And there were a couple of little side quests that they added on towards the end that you could do to get like slightly better items, or I think you could gild the Goron sword.
Right.
So it was even stronger. And there were little tweaks like that, so that was really nice. But yeah, they just need to do something with it.
I'm really surprised they haven't, because it's, as you've probably noticed from us talking about it, is much beloved, and I'm surprised they've not gone, people would pay another 40 quid for this if we tarted it up a bit, because they've done it with pretty much everything else. They didn't even do anything to, well, very little to the Mario thing, did they? The 3D All-Stars. And that sold massively, because, well, partially because they told everyone they wouldn't be able to get hold of it after like 6 months. But it still sold really well. And yeah, I'm surprised they've not gone to the Zelda cash cow and milked it a little bit more, especially with how well the new games have done as well. Because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that have played Breath of the Wild and want to experience the old games, but there's not really an accessible way to do it, short of buying some really retro tech or, like you say, playing a Switch port that isn't great and isn't particularly reliable.
I mean, it was the 25th anniversary last year of Ocarina, and they did bits. So they did like, oh, you know, here's a 25th anniversary concert that we're going to do to celebrate 25 years of Ocarina, and it's going to be held in Japan, and it's going to have the Tokyo Symphony Harmonic. And you're just like, yeah, that's great, but that's for people that can afford to fly to Tokyo. And then just did nothing else with it at all. And it's like, you're criminally missing the point of just put a small team on it, even if it takes a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, Nintendo seems to be doing that a lot recently, just completely missing massive opportunities. They put out that Mario game, didn't they? For the anniversary. Was it Mario 35 or whatever it was?
Yeah.
Where you were all competing against each other and then went, right, you've had that for a couple of months now, bye, and just took it away. And it's like, you've put all this effort into making it. People are still playing it right up until the point they took it offline. You didn't make any money out of it, so why take it away? Just leave it there if people are enjoying it. You've done all the work to create the hype. You've made zero money off it. And now you're taking it away. If they'd gone, it's free for the first 3 months and then it's 30 quid, then I can understand the business model, get people hooked on it, charge them 30 quid. But to give people it free for a couple of months and then go, nah, you're really enjoying this, aren't you? Well, too bad. I'm taking that now. You've had enough of it. Here's a Tetris version that's nowhere near as good. Enjoy. And then what was the other one they did?
F-Zero.
Which is also
the
not as good.
The 30th anniversary of F-Zero.
And it's like the logic behind these decisions is almost sadistic, to get people this interested in something and they go, no, you can't have it anymore. And then not capitalize on it in some financial way that would make it not justifiable, but understandable at least. That it just beggars belief. And I suppose they do similar with Pokemon cards, but that's more established. Like they'll do with Pokemon cards, like here's a really limited run. And once it's gone, it's gone. Oh, nobody got it, did you not? Oh, well, it's done. It's not even as if they're coming out and going, right, we'll reissue a load more, but at a higher price. It seems to be they've got this nature of, like, sadism and making things, I don't know, because it's not even like they're making things rare, because it's not like if I've got that Mario 35 game, I can sell it to someone for a lot of money. It just doesn't exist anymore. I don't get what they got out of making it to then remove it straight away.
Yeah, they did some really weird things with like Let's Plays and stuff like that. Stuff that people did out of love for a particular franchise or a particular game, where they did, oh, you know, we'll do Let's Plays. And they sort of came in with a cease and desist and went, no, you're not allowed to do that anymore. We're taking it off you. They did the same thing with the Mario All-Stars. Oh, well, here's these three games that people love. We're going to give it you for a limited time and then you can't buy it again. The 3DS servers. Oh, well,
yeah.
These servers that people still use actively because it's the last bastion of a handheld console that people still like to use. Yeah, well, it's costing us too much to run the servers. How is it costing you that much to run the bloody servers? One person goes on every couple of days and downloads a new version of Pokemon. I mean, hell, guys, come on.
Yeah, it's baffling. Some of the decisions Nintendo, and we best be careful because they'll start coming after us. I mean,
I know.
We've gone on a tangent again, but just we'll not get into it. But they've started going after Switch emulators, haven't they? Quite viciously. Yeah. I can understand that because it's a current console, and it is taking away from their actual profit margins in a significant way, because you've got this emulator that can essentially run 40, 50 quid brand new releases as soon as somebody rips them. So I can get that, and I can understand why they're going after that. Why they're going after SNES emulators and stuff like that, it does baffle me a bit more. Yes, I know those games are on the virtual marketplace, but they're losing, what, 3 or 4 quid if somebody downloads it? And I would hasten to bet, because I've been in this position myself in the past, that if the choice is between downloading a ROM or paying a fiver, I won't play the game if they take the ROM option away. So it's not like they're losing money from it, because a lot of the people that pirate the games and get the ROMs for SNES wouldn't buy the virtual console version. It's not like they're going, it's either or. It's like, no, I'm either pirating it or I'm just not bothered. So they're not losing money, technically, on most people. But yeah, that seems like a lot of effort on their part and a lot of money to prevent somebody taking a 4 quid game if they particularly want to play it. And yeah, but the Switch thing, I get. The Switch thing completely. I understand why they'd want to protect that, because it's current generation software that people can play for free, essentially. But the other stuff does baffle me a bit, why they'd be so litigious for something that wouldn't really earn them any money in the end.
And then particularly when you look at the virtual console on the Switch and you see that it's got a grand total of about 30 titles, all of which they have previously released on Game Boy Advance, DS, 3DS, Wii U, probably had a collection of it on GameCube as well. And it's like, you've obviously got the architecture and the ability to just port these things on. It's obviously not challenging for you to do it, because it's cartridge to cartridge. And it's not even that, it's virtual. It's ones and zeros at this point. And you're artificially restricting your potential usership's access, because it's like a sexual thrill they get from it. It's like, oh, we're gonna give them one more title on the virtual console this week. Oh, I'm staving off the orgasm. And it's just Nintendo, just give us all of the titles that you've got available for the NES, if you've still got the licenses for them, fair enough. The SNES, they're doing the same thing with the Sega Mega Drive and the Sega Master System. They're giving the N64 stuff some funny looks, and it's like, just, you've got them there. They're in your library. Just put them on the server. That's all we're asking. And it will stop people going out and going, oh, I'm going to ROM hack this.
Didn't they at one point get caught using a ROM that somebody else had ripped as well?
Yeah.
I'm sure I remember this. Yeah. So it's like they're stopping other people doing it and then going, oh, well, we'll have that. Seeing as you've put all the hard work in, we'll just use this. They do make some really strange decisions, Nintendo, and I don't want to get on the wrong side of them. We do love you, Nintendo, if you're listening, but just give us what we want. Give people what they want instead of, I don't know, Princess Peach Saga or whatever it's bloody called, this new one that's come out. I still haven't played it, so it might be a brilliant game. I'll reserve judgment on that one. And we do have other Mario stuff to talk about, so let's wrap Zelda up. Let's get back to that and wrap it up. I can't even remember what the highest score we've given is at the minute. Is it 95 for Pokemon Red and Blue?
Yeah, I think so.
Where's this sit?
For me, it's borderline perfect. There are as we've said, there are little niggles that over time and replays, you'll just be like, oh, for f*** sake, not this again. But I'd be pushing for like 97, 98, 99. It's so close to being perfect. It's painful for me.
I was going to say 99 before you started talking. And I don't know if there's a case for 100. I don't know if any game deserves 100. But if any game was coming close, it's this one. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give it a 99 on today's episode. People have probably just passed out. But we will give it a 99 on this episode. And what we'll do is, when we do that episode where we go through and reevaluate all the scores, we'll see where everything else sits and we'll decide whether it stays as a 99 or whether it goes up a mark or down a mark based on where we've set everything else. I think that's the fairest thing to say. Yeah. 99.
Hey, listen!
There 99. We go. So, in other news, Mario news specifically, we touched on this very, very briefly in a previous episode, but Mario Maker 1 has been completed just before the servers got taken offline. So every completable level in Mario Maker 1 was completed before it went offline, which is a massive achievement when you consider that. The community have done so well to get them all dashed off the list and done. And I think they did it a week earlier than they thought they needed to do it, wouldn't they? Because there was one level outstanding that looked completable, but with very, very... It was like a pixel-perfect jump, wasn't it, essentially, or something along those lines. And for a full week, people were trying to do it and couldn't do it. And then the guy who created it came out and said that he'd used like manipulation software to get the level uploaded without actually being able to finish it. So it turns out it wasn't a completable level and they'd finished their quest a week early and had to really, really wait for that victory celebration. So yeah, amazing, amazing work to everyone involved there. Well done. And it's just nice to see that something like that's happened. Again, Nintendo taking a server offline that was still actively being used, but I think it was 8 years old or something, was it? So you can sort of understand why, especially when there's Mario Maker 2, which I was going to say is better in every regard, but it isn't because they took all the little amiibos out of it, which were one of my favourite things in Mario Maker 1. I don't know why they took them out, but they got removed. And there's a couple of other things I think Mario Maker 1 does better, but for the most part, Mario Maker 2 is just an improvement in every area. You can have slopes, you can... Like, the screen scrolls quicker when you actually play in the game. I didn't realise this until I watched somebody playing one of the old ones to try and strike some of those levels off on YouTube the other day. And they were like, the vertical scrolling on it is so slow. And as soon as they pointed it out, you could see, like, Mario was hitting the top of the screen before it was catching him up. And the same on the side, the horizontal scrolling a little bit, but not as much as the vertical. So, yeah, Mario Maker 2 is just a generally better offering, I suppose. But how long it'll be before they decide that doesn't deserve servers anymore and start shutting those down, we'll have to see. But massive, massive respect to the people who've sorted that and got it all completed before it shut down. And if you own a copy of Mario Maker 1 now, you've got practically obsolete bit of tech on your hands because there's not really much point to it. You can design levels for your mate, I suppose, to come over and play in your living room, yeah. But that's about as much as you can do with it now, which is a shame, but it was always going to happen, wasn't it, eventually?
And I think that's testament to the sort of fan base that Nintendo have bred over the decades. They are a passionate bunch, and we are a passionate bunch, to be fair, because both Nintendo... Well, I'm a Nintendo kid and you're a Nintendo fan. So it's... Yeah, and it's stuff like Ocarina and Mario Maker and all the other Nintendo titles that we've talked about on this channel that do really... I think probably, without hyperbole, makes them the epitome of the video game company. A lot of the time, they make their business decisions based on fans, what the fans want. Big tech companies and conglomerates and stuff like that, and gaming companies as a whole, are a bit of a shifty bunch, to say it in the politest way, really. They do some dodgy business decisions. They make questionable, unethical business decisions at times that don't benefit the fans, and they just do it to make a quick buck. Whereas Nintendo, although they are in it to make money, by and large, do things because it's what the fan base wants and it's what the fan base expects. And they are held to a, I think, a higher standard than Sony, Microsoft, Ubisoft, EA, stuff like that. They are held to such a higher standard that I think it's probably part of the documents you have to sign when you get hired by Nintendo that you have to uphold the highest standard of business decision making and productivity and passion and drive and stuff like that. I think they only hire the cream of the crop to make their games.
Yeah, we've been harsh to them today, really, because they do a lot for fans, like you say. There are some baffling decisions that seem to fly in the face of what fans want, but on the whole, they've always done the beneficial thing for fans, I'd say, in the majority of cases. And I think, to your point about them sort of being held in a higher regard, I think part of that comes from, for me, if you look at PlayStation or you look at Xbox and you look at their proprietary mascot games, so like your Crash Bandicoots, your Halos, there aren't that many that you can actually name when you think about it, Uncharted, that kind of thing. You look at Uncharted and you go, oh, it's a Naughty Dog game. Even though it's a Sony exclusive, you associate it with being a Naughty Dog game. Same for Crash Bandicoot, Naughty Dog, or I can't remember the guys who did the remake and the fourth one, but you associate it with a studio. Whereas you look at a Nintendo game and go, Mario, that's Nintendo. Kirby, that's Nintendo. Zelda, that's Nintendo. So you've almost got this buffer for Sony and Microsoft. Even when you look at Halo and it's like, it's Microsoft Studios, isn't it? You don't sort of immediately go, oh, Microsoft have made a rubbish game. You go, Microsoft Studios have made a rubbish game and they work for Microsoft. And do you know what I mean? It's that there's a degree of separation. Whereas Nintendo games, it's Mario is Nintendo. This Mario game's rubbish. Therefore, Nintendo have made a rubbish game. You never sort of look at if there's a sub company involved or whether it's been given to a team that sits outside of the core Nintendo team and that's why it's not gone right. You just go, oh, Nintendo have made a rubbish game. And I think that's why, because they make so many of their own games for the consoles that you just associate them with them and then one of them's not good and you immediately blame Nintendo themselves. Whereas on a PlayStation or an Xbox, you don't. You go, oh, it's the studio that's made a rubbish game. It's Game Mill that's gone and knackered that up, not Sony. Do you know what I mean? And it's just that accountability that these are all your babies, Nintendo, and you should be treating them better than this when a bad game comes out. And I think that's probably what it is. And there's been, I don't think there's any Nintendo franchise that's completely unscathed in that regard. Mario's had its share of mediocre games and then genuinely bad games, like mostly edutainment ones, to be fair, like Mario is Missing and stuff like that. But there's been some really bad games out there with Mario's name on it. Probably not actually made by Nintendo. Again, if you look into it, it's probably another studio that made like Mario is Missing and that kind of thing. Or Mario, was it Mario's Time Machine or something? That other one that was like edutainment that was really weird.
Yeah, and Mario typing and...
Yeah.
Sort of Mario speak and stuff like that taught you to read and what have you. It's weird.
And then you look at Zelda, probably not that many bad, really bad Zelda games, but I'd say like Hyrule Warriors wore its welcome fairly quickly.
Spirit Tracks.
Yeah, Spirit Tracks, Phantom Hourglass to an extent, I didn't particularly enjoy. So there are poor Zelda games. Metroid, I don't know, Metroid, yeah. I suppose you've got that one. And then the Metroid ones seem to always be middling to good, don't they? Like there's the few that are exceptional and then there's the ones that are middling to good and then you've got maybe one that isn't great. And then what else we got? Kirby has had so many games that it's hard to keep track of. And the majority of them, again, middling to good. A couple that are absolutely amazing. Some that don't, like, are very, very bare bones. So there's hardly anything to them, but they're still charging £30 for them. Pokemon, I don't even want to get into how many bad Pokemon games have been over the years. As many as there have been good, I think, by this point.
Yeah.
Pretty much every Nintendo franchise has got its stinkers, and you associate them directly with Nintendo. So when Pokemon Ranger or whatever it was came out, which apparently people like, but I thought was one of the worst Pokemon games I've ever played. you just go, Nintendo's made a rubbish Pokemon game, when actually they've probably farmed it off to someone and they've made a rubbish Pokemon game. But yeah, there's that level of accountability, like you say. And even in how they carry themselves in interviews and stuff, you watch old like E3 presentations, and Sony and Nintendo, some of their people have said some absolutely bizarre things, and it's been pulled up in the news and stuff. Whereas Nintendo tends to play it safe, and it's just the games, isn't it? They don't...
Yeah.
I suppose they do have staff that you would recognise, but it never seems to be more about them, if that makes sense. So, like, the guy... What's the guy called that does the... That used to do the Xbox ones? Is it Reggie? Yeah. He became, like, bigger than Xbox, didn't he? He was, like, the guy who was, like, more famous than the console he was promoting at one point. Whereas Nintendo... They tend to stay a lot more humble, I suppose, is the difference.
Yeah, they are very stoically Japanese in the interviews and stuff like that. They are incredibly humble, and it's almost like they're subservient, really, in interviews and stuff like that. It's almost like, here's this game we've got to offer you, oh master. If you wouldn't mind spending the next 5 minutes watching this trailer... And then we'll talk you through the aspects of the trailer that you've seen, rather than Sony, who chucks up a 25-second pre-rendered trailer of a game that's not reflective of the final product, and then goes, right, that'll be £80, please, to pre-order this. And you sort of go, oh, right, okay, Jesus Christ, fair enough. But Nintendo and Sega are the last bastions of having a mascot. No other sort of gaming company franchise really these days that you would look at and go, oh, that's like stuff like Rayman is Ubisoft, but you wouldn't immediately go, oh, that's Ubisoft. Whereas Sega has Sonic and Knuckles and Tails, and Nintendo's got the pantheon that it's got, but they're the last two.
I think you've hit the nail on the head with the cultural difference. Sony and... I mean, even though Sony aren't an American company, then you've got Microsoft, which are. They are very American in how they promote their games and consoles. So it's all rah, 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 this game is going to be the best thing ever, but we've only got this tiny little clip of it, so you're just going to have to take our word for it. Whereas Nintendo go, here's 10 minutes of gameplay. We think it's probably going to be good and you'll enjoy it. And this is what it's about, rather than being like, here's a brilliant game to show you. So, yeah, I think it is the cultural thing. You're right. You've hit the nail on the head with that. But I just much prefer the way Nintendo do things like that. And I think it generally makes for a better experience, because I can't ever think of a time where I've seen a trailer for a Nintendo game and gone, that looks fantastic. And then when I've got the game, it's been something completely different. Whereas I can think of a hell of a lot of times when Microsoft and Sony games have done exactly that, and you get something that isn't even remotely similar to what you've been promoted. And it's not to say they don't release great games. They obviously do. There's some fantastic games out there for all three consoles. But yeah, Nintendo just tend to be a little bit more upfront about their own IPs, I suppose. Anyway, that's enough of that. We've run long again. We only plan on doing 40 minutes. I think we could have talked for 2 hours about Zelda, to be fair. So we might have to do a follow-up episode on maybe on Zelda as a whole, rather than just individual games, and we'll pick up that. I'm almost certain there'll be Zelda in the 100 Nintendo games to play before you die, so maybe we just do a second episode on each game rather than discounting them like we're going to do. But before we leave, it is time for me to do the Patreon shout-outs. So in the couple of coins tier, we have got Harry Flynn this week. In the Bucket Kickers tier, we've got Ric Flair. And still in the Avatarnished tier, as of just before recording, we have got the Sweaty Llama, who is incredibly happy with his llama picture, from what I've been told. So thank you to you guys for helping us out. If you want to become a Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/bucketlistgamers. We've got an exclusive episode up there at the minute. We are in the middle of recording another exclusive episode as we speak. We've come up with the idea. We just need to actually talk about it. And there is also that elusive special clip on there to find out what made Eddie laugh, which I'm sure most people have probably worked out by now. But if you want to actually hear it in all its glory, that is the only way you're ever going to get to hear it. So please, if you want to find out, go over and subscribe for that. It's available on all three tiers. All four tiers, sorry. We do have a fourth tier, but it's so expensive nobody's ever touched it, which we didn't expect anyone would. But we put it on there just in case. And yeah, that is my little plug for Patreon, which is getting better and better every episode. I'm getting smoother with it. I get the web address right now, which is a big benefit compared to the first few that I did. And yeah, unless you've got any other business in the gaming world, we will call it there.
There are some bits in the gaming world, but do you know what? I think it's just nice for once to have had a relatively chipper, relatively positive episode where we've not felt like, oh, God's sake, I'm not looking forward to recording this one at all or talking about this because I don't think we've got enough out of it. But yeah, no, it has just been just a nice little trip down memory lane to remember Ocarina and how much it still kicks ass today. And if you haven't played it, what are you doing? Just find an N64 and go play it.
And as for future episodes, we've got 3 games left. And one of them, I don't know what we're going to do. So I don't want to commit to anything for next week because, one, I'm in the middle of playing through so I can talk about it properly. One, we don't really have that much to say even though we do like the game. And then one, we have no idea what we're going to do. So it could be a couple of interesting weeks coming up. Keep your ear out for those. But until then, I will say that is goodbye from me.
And that's goodbye from me. Hey, listen!